It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The definition of a family is ever-changing in America. According to the Pew Research Center, that definition now includes both parents, just one parent, grandparents, and other extended family members, as well as parents of the same sex. But marriage does not seem to be the prominent factor in the definition of family, certainly not as much as it used to be. About 6 in 10 men and women who have never married say they would like to, but only about half of adults are married. It would seem that matrimony is not living up to people's expectations. In exploring those expectations, it's hard to miss the complications of gender roles. Does a more egalitarian marriage make for a more happy marriage? I'm joined now in studio by Dr. Christine Whelan, visiting assistant professor in the University of Pittsburgh Department of Sociology. Dr. Whelan, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
And also with us is Connie Lappa, a psychotherapist with Isley Counseling Associates, who has worked with individuals and couples for over 25 years. She's also an adjunct professor at Robert Morris University and the University of Pittsburgh. Connie Lappa, good to have you.
Thank you.
And you can join the conversation by calling us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address, esspgh@wesa.fm. And you can reach us on Twitter at esspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. How have expectations based in gender shaped your relationships? Are traditional gender roles realistic for your current relationship, or do they cause confusion and, in some cases, resentment? We'd like to hear from you. 412-246-2002. Christine Whelan, Connie Lappa, what are people's attitudes about marriage? Christine, let's start with you.
Marriage used to be the sort of starting point for a young adult's life. It was the first thing you did, and then you would grow together as a couple. And now it's considered the end point of a sort of young adulthood trajectory. So people really value marriage still in the United States, but they are doing it later. And we're also seeing kind of a diverging demographics in terms of who is actually marrying. The more educated you are, the more likely you are to get married. The less educated and less affluent you are, the more likely you are to cohabit and have serial relationships, form fragile families, and never marry. So we're seeing, I think, some pretty concerning trends when it comes to marriage in the United States.
Why would those trends be related to whether somebody has a college degree or not?
It's a great question, and it's something that we sociologists look at a lot. One explanation is that marriage is about sort of valuing a long-term commitment and making a long-term choice to be with one person. And that is something that is not as available if you are in a pool of maybe less reliable mates, or if you haven't made long-term commitments to education or other things in your past.
Does a longer lifespan have something to do with the fact that we're seeing people wait to get married? For example, one of the statistics I saw in the Pew Research, and this goes back a few years to 2008, so it's not the most current information, but I'm guessing it hasn't changed much. And that was that in 1960, for example, people in their 20s, 60% of people in their 20s were married.
Sure.
In the United States of America. And now that's below 30%. It's been cut by more than half. And basically people are saying the 20s are for what? Not marriage, apparently. But what are they doing instead of getting married? Connie?
They're finishing their education. They're fulfilling their personal goals. People are feeling that they have more time. And so they can always get married later. They're putting off having children. So there's not that pressure to marry for that reason. And they're wanting to establish financial independence and stability before they get into some kind of legal commitment.
Is there also some idea that, you know, I'm in my 20s, so I'm going to party?
Absolutely. It's an extended adolescence that we're seeing in many ways. But the financial point that Connie brings up is a really good one. Again, we used to see two people joining in matrimony who had, you know, two dimes to rub together, right? And now we're seeing a minimum of a sort of $20,000 wedding, that's the whole white wedding industry, as the thing that you, quote-unquote, have to do if you want to get married. That sets people back in terms of waiting to get married. And you have this idea that you should be financially set before marriage. I give this in surveys to my students in my sociology of marriage class. I say, how important is it to you to be financially set up prior to marriage? And 80 to 90% of the students say, it's very important for me to do this. When are you going to become financially set in your 20s in this economy?
Yeah, especially if you've got the student loan issue.
Absolutely.
Well, a very interesting point, Christine. And Connie, you counsel people. There was a very romantic notion about people starting out together with nothing back when people were getting married in their late teens and 20s. So now today, do you find that if that financial stability necessarily needs leads to a good marriage?
I think it can reduce the numbers of conflict around finances, certainly. I think there is a certain level of expectations on both people's part that the other person's going to be able to contribute equally in some way to the relationship financially and you know, especially in this time of financial uncertainty,
mm-hmm.
You know, if there isn't that promise that's kept, then that can lead to conflict.
But if there's also all this money being spent on the wedding, mm-hmm. you know, if you're having the $20,000 wedding, you might be putting yourself in the hole, you would think. Or
I see people delaying getting married until they've saved up the money for the wedding.
Interesting.
Yeah, really, when it comes down to finances and relationships, I think it's mostly about shared values or a discord within sort of the your values. And so when you're fighting, you're not necessarily fighting about money for the most part. You're fighting about what to do with that money. Mm-hmm. So if two people really do want to save up for that $20,000 wedding, and that's very important to them, if two people really need feel that they need that money for their financial stability and their relationship, that's one thing. The problems start when two people have different ideas about money and aren't communicating.
Yes.
We talked at the outset about the whole changing perception of gender roles and what mm-hmm. those roles should be. In what ways do you see, either Christine or Connie, in what ways do you see gender-based expectations playing a part in relationship struggles? Connie?
I often see people coming in after the birth of the first child. It seems that with that added responsibility, the gender role expectations really kick in. Who's going to stay home when the child is sick? Who's going to drop the child off at daycare? Who's going to do the laundry? It becomes much more unequal, and the resentment grows. And it tends to be, I think, the female partner that shoulders more of the responsibility. I think that's what society expects, too.
The socialization aspect of this is really powerful. There's been some great research done on couples who cohabit. And in cohabitating couples tend to have more egalitarian relationships in terms of splitting the household chores. Both partners work for pay outside the home. But what's, I think, very interesting about the research is then when you see these couples who then get married, the same couples who you had looked at with these egalitarian relationships, you tend to see a move toward more traditional division of labor. And in part, that's because we have a socialized idea of what husband and wife roles are. We've been raised with these ideas that the woman, quote unquote, is the better mother, is the better parent, should be doing more of the household work. And then women typically feel a great sense of resentment that how is it that my bargain changed all of a sudden?
So, Christine, what are the pros and cons of traditional gender-based relationships today?
Again, it's going to really be on a couple-by-couple basis, but there is something to be said for division of labor. You don't want to be tripping over each other all the time, and certainly it depends what works for the couple. So, for example, I know plenty of couples for whom when the man comes home, he wants to just be left alone in the kitchen to make dinner, have a couple glasses of wine, and do his thing and create a wonderful meal for the family. That's great. That works for them. For other couples, the woman would be doing all the housework and very much resented and saying, you know, why are you just playing with the kids as opposed to helping me around the house? All these very everyday fights center around a lack of communication, really, right, about what you want your gender roles to be. And I'm sure, Connie, that's what you see in your practice.
Well, and Connie, how useful is it that if the ideal thing is to figure out a way to have those relationship roles perfectly balanced in whatever way suits whichever couple is involved, how useful is that? And is that even possible?
I don't think it's possible to have a perfect balance, but each couple has their own balance that'll work for them. And so it may not be this this chore for that chore, but as long as there can be a balance of the responsibilities in whatever way they can do that, and so that they each have some personal time. What I see is a lot of women ending up with very little personal time and being very resentful of that and getting worn down. So if they can find a way to communicate about that, communicate about their expectations, listen to each other, realize they came in with to this relationship with certain expectations and they may need to negotiate that.
People, pundits and sociologists and just people who observe the state of things in general tend to say that we tend to blame any number of problems in society on the breakdown, the quote-unquote breakdown or so-called breakdown of the American family. And a lot of times it goes back to one parent or another staying home, usually the woman, the wife and mother. When it's economically feasible, does it help a relationship when one spouse stays home to run the household, Christine?
First of all, we really idealize the families of the past, right?
The Aussie and Harriet.
Absolutely. I mean, let's not forget the feminine mystique and all of those very and all those very, very unhappy women who felt that they were trapped in those suburban homes. However, if you have two couples who are working 50, 60 plus hours a week and going great guns in their two members of a couple going great guns in their career, that is hard to find time to have a family meal or to plan a vacation. Those things are easier if somebody is more devoted to kinkeeping and the upkeep of the home. Does that have to be the woman? Certainly not. And we're seeing an increasing number of men who, men are the ones who are more likely to be laid off in the last couple of years in the current economic crisis. So especially for young couples and young educated couples, we're seeing more men who are taking on non-traditional roles and doing more of this house husbanding or the sort of the stay-at-home dad role. That's working for a lot more couples than I think we would have ever thought.
Yeah, and I think it can work whether it's the man or the woman, as long as whoever it is that's taking on more of the household responsibility feels appreciated for mm-hmm. that role, that mm-hmm. role is valued, and that they still feel they have a voice in the decision-making in the relationship.
And that's where negotiating really comes in. And I this is what I tell my young female students, is that you will do all of the negotiating that you're going to do about who's going to take out the trash and do the chores before you walk down the aisle or before you have your first child, whichever comes first. And that's because the investments that you make in yourself in terms of your human capital, your education, your job skills, that's what gives you bargaining power within your relationship. And we don't mean to kind of set it up as an adversarial thing, but that bargaining power really matters.
We're talking with Dr. Christine Whelan, who is an assistant professor with the University of Pittsburgh Department of Sociology. And also with us is Connie Lappa, a psychotherapist with Isley Counseling Associates. And she is also an adjunct professor at Robert Morris University and the University of Pittsburgh as well. And we had tweeted out our question, are traditional gender roles realistic for your current relationship, or do they cause confusion and in some cases resentment? In response to that question, Leah writes, nope, better at the task, it's yours. Sometimes I feel I got the shorter end. He cooks, I do most dishes, he does laundry, I fold. Does that, Christine, you're smiling?
Absolutely. That seems to work. As long as we don't set up, and I see this in a lot of relationships, Connie, I'm sure you do too, where we set up that the woman is just going to be better at these lots of things because she is a woman. So as long as we don't set up the idea that, oh, she must be better at doing the laundry or must be better at caring for a child because she is genetically female, As long as we don't set that up, then yes, whoever is better and whoever enjoys the task more should do it.
And how about for men? It's just, isn't it sometimes unfairly assumed that the guy knows how to fix everything?
Sure.
Yes.
These are unfair gender assumptions, and we can't do this. And it's unfair to assume that a guy can't change a diaper or soothe a baby in the middle of the night. There's just no reason to believe this.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's the woman who prefers to do the yard work or cut the grass, that's something that is good for her, and she enjoys doing that.
Right. I mean, it's sort of amusing that in 2013 we're still having this conversation, because these things should be rather obvious. But when you get down to the nuts and bolts of relationships, we time travel back to the 1950s.
412-246-2002 if you'd like to get in on the conversation. We have Jim in Oakland joining us. Jim, welcome.
Hello,
to
Hello, Paul. I love the show. Now, I'm blind, and I know there's a lot of divorce among blind and the disabled people. I'm single, and I'm lonely sometimes, and I know a lot of my blind friends who have graduated from high school, they've been married and divorced 4, 5, 6, 7, or 8 times since graduation, I know this, and it's really sad, but it happens among the blind. And there's a lot of unemployment among the blind, too. And a lot of blind couples also live together outside of marriage also.
Well, what about the high rates of divorce? Jim is saying that, and I don't have any statistics to back that up, but Jim is saying that as far as he knows, among his circle of friends, there is a high rate of divorce. Connie, what do you know about that? What is the cause?
I don't know a lot of statistics, particularly with visual disabilities, but just with disabilities in general, it just puts an extra layer of stress on the relationship. And if people don't communicate about their expectations and their needs, just as in any relationship, resentments can grow. People often do a lot of mind reading in relationships. And that can lead to conflicts because they don't understand where the other person's coming from.
We were talking earlier about the big wedding that when you talk about certain traditions, we seem to be getting back to the more lavish weddings of the past that are not cheap. Have you found that some couples are more focused on the wedding and not the marriage, Connie?
Yes, I think there's still a little bit of that romanticism that people start off with in relationships, and even people who wait to get married, there's still a little bit of that idealism about how things are going to be, and there's a lot of focus on that wedding and not talking so much about what's going to happen after the wedding with the expectations.
Christine, you were nodding.
Yeah, there's this idea that if you have a huge, lavish white wedding – that you are somehow inoculating yourself against the odds of divorce. That if you put down all of this money, if you make this big commitment in front of everybody that you've spent all this money, then you couldn't possibly get divorced. And our consumer culture also kind of sells us a bill of goods on this, that you need a full china set and crystal service to have a happy union. That's not the case. Also, you had mentioned that we're sort of going back to lavish weddings of the past. That's actually not true. We are having more lavish weddings than we ever have in society.
Wow.
People used to get married in their living rooms. People used to get married in very small ceremonies in suits. And this was not this idea of the big white wedding. My doctoral thesis advisor always said that he thought as divorce rates went up, the cost of marriage too will go up, because it's the sort of trying to make a credible commitment that you are not going to get divorced. How could you get divorced if you spent $50,000 or $100,000 on your wedding? Well, obviously, there is no correlation there, and we see people with very lavish weddings. I think, Kim Kardashian, for example.
Right, exactly.
Right? That marriage didn't last, and then that was millions and millions of dollars.
We're talking about the changing definition of marriage, of traditional marriage roles, and also the decline in the number of people getting married for any number of reasons, with a couple of very interesting guests, Dr. Christine Whelan, assistant professor at the University of Pittsburgh Department of Sociology, and also Connie Lappa, a psychotherapist who also teaches at Robert Morris University and the University of Pittsburgh. We'd like to hear about your relationship and also some of the problems that you have experienced from evolving gender roles. How have expectations based in gender shaped your relationships? And are traditional gender roles realistic for your current relationship, or do they cause confusion and, in some cases, resentment? Our phone number, 412-246-2002, if you'd like to join the conversation. Our email address, ESSPGH at WESA.FM. You can reach us on Twitter at ESSPGH and follow the conversation at hashtag EPLive. We'll be back to take your calls. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.
I want to settle down. I want to settle down. Won't you settle down with me? Settle down.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are talking about marriage, not living up to people's expectations, and in exploring those expectations, the complications of gender roles. Does a more egalitarian marriage make for a happy marriage or relationship in general? How have expectations based in gender shaped your relationships? And are traditional gender roles realistic for your current relationship, or do they cause confusion and, in some cases, resentment? 412-246-2002, the number to call. Our guests are Christine Whelan, Dr. Christine Whelan, assistant professor in the University of Pittsburgh Department of Sociology, and also Connie Lappa, a psychotherapist and sex therapist with Isley Counseling Associates. She also teaches at both Pitt and Robert Morris University. 412-246-2002, the number to call if you'd like to join the conversation. And we have Samuel calling from the Parkway. Samuel, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Greetings. I'm no longer from the Parkway. Pulled to the side of the road, found a shady spot.
Thank you
Always
for being
to have fun conversations for that.
Yes, thank you for being a responsible listener, Samuel.
Absolutely, absolutely. I just was listening to the conversation, and the first thing that made me want to call right away was the fact that there was a little bit of that gender stereotypical, you know, evaluation of people, and being having closed a successful medical practice to be a stay-home dad because my wife had a better job and got better benefits to take care of, you know, any potential insurance problems with the children. The only thing I've ever found that my wife is a little bit more suited to be able to deal with is the baby crying. I'm not sure why that is, but it doesn't seem to cause as much stress for her as it does for me and any other males that I know. But in general, you know, I find that being a stay-home dad, it was much more important to, you know, to be able to grow with my children and take part in them, having come from a home where my father was an artist. And so being an artist, he spent a lot more time with his canvas than he did with his kids necessarily. Not that there's anything really wrong with that, but later in life, one does sort of notice that lack. And I just didn't want to have my kids raised in the same fashion. So I don't have any regrets from it at all. And I guess that sort of puts me firmly into the changing gender roles of modern society.
Well, and that's a very interesting story, Samuel. And I'm curious, Christine, for example, how common is Sam's story in this day and age?
It's increasingly common. So young men especially who had absent fathers or fathers who were really prioritizing career over family, when they have families of their own, are often saying, you know, I want to do things a little bit differently. And it's not about gender roles. It's really about who is doing what more often. So if you're the one who is spending more time with the kids, you're going to be better at working and raising your kids than the partner who is spending less time doing it. So Samuel's story, this is great. I mean, he's really excelling at being a parent, and he and his wife are finding who does better at each individual task and splitting it up in a wonderful way. I think this is sort of the wave of the future, honestly, and it's not going to fall, hopefully, down gender roles, but more by interest and ability.
412-246-2002. Let's go to Reese from Point Breeze. Reese, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hey, I want to thank you for having me on.
You're welcome.
That's just a kind of point of discussion. You know, if we are to look at gender as kind of a construct and malleable and that motherly roles can be transferred to father and vice versa. Where it kind of comes in what seems to be more of a biological drive or might be a constructed drive of feeling masculine or feminine, you know, despite having multiple roles.
I'm sorry, Risa, can you repeat that again, please?
Yeah, so if the roles are malleable and we see gender roles increasingly being kind of swapped between biological genders, where comes in the importance, say, of a woman feeling feminine or a man feeling masculine, despite kind of a man raising kids or a woman working and kind of fucking tradition?
I guess it's how you define masculine and feminine. It doesn't have to be defined by who does more of the child care. The concept of whether or not you feel feminine is much more complicated than that, and the same with the idea of being masculine.
And also it's sort of in terms of we are socialized to give sort of power to a woman or power to a man when they're doing particular roles that we deem as appropriate for their sex. And fortunately, we're seeing that change a little bit. So I think the concern would come if a stay-at-home father, for example, feels demasculated by society because he is not bringing home a big paycheck. That, I think, would cause some masculinity crisis issues for him that really shouldn't be there for other reasons.
There are studies looking at the popularity of so-called men's work, shows like Ice Road Truckers and Deadliest Catch. Mm-hmm. As men have taken on more gender-neutral roles, they also find refuge in shows with manly men. On the women's side, she also wants to have a masculine guy but have him respect her independence. As a therapist, Connie, how do you address this disconnect?
I think, again, by having people redefine what is masculine, what is feminine, instead of just making a very narrow definition, to be able to see that there's many aspects of that and it doesn't have to follow along these specific roles. I mean, when you think back to the 1700s and men wore stockings and powdered wigs, and the ideal man was somebody who didn't really do a lot of physical work. You know, he ran a business, or he was a landholder, and he wasn't out there doing the physical work, but he was still considered very much a man.
I mean, also, I think we have to look at some of all the sort of media influences as well.
Sure.
You know, we have Don Draper on Mad Men, and he's the woman that women think that he is so sexy and wonderful in so many ways, but nobody really wants to be in a relationship with him because he's a jerk.
That kind of guy that with the cigarette going and the martini in one hand and being a womanizer and just you know kind of a jerk, but and yet there's some
we have very
primitive instinct in men that.
Confidence is sexy,
but we also just have very complicated ideas about what is sexually attractive versus what kind of person we want to be a partner and raise our children. And I think Connie probably can speak more to this, mm-hmm. but perhaps many women and men as well want a different kind of partner in the bedroom than they do in the living room with their kids.
Right.
Interesting. And when you talk about the relaxing some of the gender stereotypes, or at least with regard to one parent or the other, whether it's the husband or the wife wanting to stay at home with the children, does it really come down to, you know, who really wants to be there and is not going to resent not being able to go out in the workforce if that's where their dream is?
I think so, yes. Although we again, these couples are not existing in a void. So we have lots of pressure from our parents, from our friends, from the media, from society in general, telling us what we quote-unquote should and should not be doing. And those messages are changing a little bit.
How often do people buy into that? You mentioned the feminine mystique, which dispelled the idea that women were happy to stay at home and bake cakes and take care of the kids and do chores around the house all day long. even though the media was beating that message into women, especially in the 50s and 60s in the electronic mass media that, you know,
sure.
Women, how white do you want your wash to be? Won't that make you happy? You know, that kind of thing.
But we still have those media images very often.
But do we buy into them?
I think we buy into them more often than we realize. I think really that those messages of socialization are very powerful and occur when we're young and impressionable in ways that we don't realize. So can we totally reinvent our relationships? Yes, certain people can. If we try to reinvent it and find it a struggle, I don't think I'd blame you and your individual relationship. I would look at this as a larger societal issue. Plus, quite frankly, we have to see some other large scale changes to enable this to work. We don't have the parental leave options available are really very challenging. So yes, there's maternity leave. There's not a whole lot of paternity leave, and the maternity leave is really pretty terrible to begin with. So we're not allowing families to kind of go this non-traditional route financially and in terms of support if that is our cultural goal.
412-246-2002, if you'd like to join the conversation with our guests, Dr. Christine Whelan and Connie Lampa. We have Donna from Oakmont. Donna, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. Thanks for waiting.
Hello, thank you. Yes, I was calling. I wanted to – your conversation so far has been really interesting. My husband and I have been married for 18 years. We make about the same income, and it just happens to be that my employer is a little more flexible. So it seems that a lot of the times I'm doing some of the roles, parenting roles, you know, errands, running around. They're teenagers now, so it's a little bit easier. But it seems like I was kind of – it just worked for us because of my employment. We had, like, what I always call ebbs and tides, where every – year or maybe even 2 years, I would pull back the reins and say, hey, wait a minute, like, I'm taking on too much of this and I need some help. And he always came in and helped. But that's not why I'm really calling. What I'm calling for was, so I have a son and a daughter, and I was wondering if your panel could give suggestions or tips on how to, mostly with my son more than anything, try to encourage that egalitarian attitude for when they choose their spouse, if they choose a spouse. Obviously, from what you talked about at the beginning of the conversation, they may not even do that. But so I was wondering if you could give some tips on how to raise and how to work with your kids so that they understand that, you know, this works for me and your dad. But
to impart those egalitarian values.
Yeah, like,
right. Okay, well, let's
we don't want them to think that the way we do it is the right way. There's all different ways. So
sure,
I'm going to actually hang up and just listen.
All right, Donna. Well, thank you. That's a good question. And Christine is chomping at
the
bit.
So first of all, this generation of young men has been raised with perhaps a female doctor, female teachers, female role models of all sorts. So the idea that a woman's place is in the home is not something that young men really are – that's not a message that the younger generation is really getting. Plus, your son has seen you working outside the home and seen that as part of a good marriage and a good working relationship. What kind of relationship will he choose to get into? Well, that's going to be a personal choice and sort of modeled after what he's seen in the home. But it doesn't sound like your relationship is particularly it sounds like it's probably more the norm than an aberration and probably a very good role model for your son. I mean, Connie.
Yeah, and I think the best thing that you've modeled is that negotiation, that communication, mm-hmm. which is very important. And I don't know, what responsibilities your son has. But, for example, I have a son, and one of the things I did was expect that he was going to start doing his own laundry in high school and start to work, you know, and do some of the housework, you know, as well as my daughter.
That.
Right. Sometimes he did. But it just you
it
know,
was
so.
If anything like me, it was, you know, I might have gotten it in the laundry basket.
So, you know, him getting those messages, hey, this is – you know, part of your role too. And then encouraging him that when he does get into a serious relationship, that he does talk about the expectations. There's a nice book out there. It's called The Hard Questions and 100 Questions to Ask Before You Say I Do, I think is the title of it. And it can help couples go through and look at the different areas, you know, money, sex, chores, and talk about those. This can be a nice guide ahead of time.
I second that recommendation. I give that book out to my students all the time in my sociology of marriage class. It's an excellent book.
412-246-2002. Let's go to Sean in McMurray. Sean, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. Go ahead with your comment or question.
I was watching a program and I saw that the correlation between life expectancy and divorce rate is proportional, in that women and men are less dependent on each other to survive, so their likelihood to be divorced is increased.
Hmm. But Christine, what about that?
So certainly we're living longer, and so when somebody is in their 60s and has been married to somebody for 25 or 30 years, that's not the end of their life. So if that marriage isn't going well, they're more likely to end that marriage now than they would have been in the past, because they think, oh my goodness, another 30 years with you, you know, that's I'm not going to be able to make it. So certainly we're seeing more folks in their midlife getting divorced. But in terms of life longevity and marriage, certainly for men, we see that married men tend to live longer than single men. Unfortunately for women, that marriage boost does not seem to similarly occur. Right. So
life expectancy?
It does not tend to boost a woman's life expectancy to be married. But women tend to live longer generally, and so we see more single women in their 80s and 90s than we do single men.
What about, as we talk about, and we've got just a couple minutes left, but Connie, as a sex therapist, how does some of this marital pressure with dividing chores and paying the bills, raising children, how does it, you know, in terms of how it impacts a couple's sex life, how much does that figure into the equation of a happy marriage or just a happy relationship in general if the parents aren't married?
I frequently see couples coming in for sex therapy because somebody has a lower desire, and sometimes when you explore that, the source of that is inequities in the distribution of responsibilities. And so one person, more typically the woman, but I've had it be the other way around, is shouldering the burden of the responsibilities. They're tired, they're worn out, they're feeling resentful. And so then when their partner approaches them for sex, they're not interested. You know, their desire has gone down. You know, I do use the example now and then that sometimes doing the dishes is foreplay.
And what have you seen in working with straight and same-sex couples? What might straight couples learn from same-sex couples about having a more egalitarian relationship?
I think there is a lot more communication about expectations. I think there's a lot more—
Among same-sex couples?
Same-sex couples, and a lot more negotiation and a lot more division of labor according to what the other person prefers to do, what the other person's better at doing. It's just not based on gender roles, and I think that— heterosexual couples could learn a lot from that.
We have a tweet from Lori who says, been married 36 years, which included living together before, and 50-50 marriage works for us. I'm assuming that means a 50-50 split of the chores and responsibilities. My husband was extremely involved in our daughter's upbringing. Glad to see our younger male relatives are doing the same. And again, that's from Lori. It's been an interesting discussion. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but I want to thank each of our guests, Dr. Christine Whelan, visiting assistant professor in the University of Pittsburgh Department of Sociology. Dr. Whelan, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And also with us has been Connie Lappa, psychotherapist, sex therapist with Isley Counseling Associates, adjunct professor at Robert Morris and the University of Pittsburgh. Connie, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Coming up, Major League Baseball's All-Star Game turns 80. Our sports guy, Bob Dvorak, on how it got started. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.